The Mariah crew in the studio this this late morning with Ricardo, Arthur, Troy, Lime, and Kendall. And we're blessed with the presence of collector extraordinaire and international legend Randy Knight. Excited to have you here, Randy. Legend. You're turning beet red.
International man of mystery.
The man of mystery is blushing. He blushes. Yeah, we... The Mariah team attempted to do a podcast about bonsai as a sustainable art form, and it cracked a lot of doors, and I think trap doors, maybe, or just opened up a lot of conversation that we recognized we needed to explore further before we put our opinion and voice out there about that. But it's interesting to have Randy at Mariah and just get to sit down and rap with you about sort of collecting your life, what took you to what you're doing now and all that stuff. But also you're in the mountains maybe more than anybody and understanding sort of what the scene is in the mountains, what you're seeing and stuff. So you just want to tell everybody how you got started collecting maybe?
Sure. So like a lot of the guys that want to collect now, I wanted trees that I just couldn't afford, couldn't find, weren't available. Mm-hmm. That started me collecting the landscape. Then I started to grow trees in the ground. I grew trees in the ground for quite maybe 5 or 6 years before I ever collected a tree, really. And that yielded some good results because in the mid-90s, there were no trees mm-hmm. to speak of that you could buy that weren't imports. I would say that in about 2000 is when I started to get serious about collecting trees in the mountains. And it just happened by fluke, you know, hunting trips primarily. I'd see trees out there that I would think I could take. I had limited success with that. I didn't really know about collecting rock at the time. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time just taking what I look back now as junk, stuff that would look better on a burn pile than in a bonsai pot. So really, it was me just trying to get my hands on better stuff that was unavailable. And from there, it's just, that was 17 years ago.
That was 17 years ago. No kidding.
Yeah. Well, probably in about 2000.
Wow. Yeah. Huh. 2018. Go figure. So you and I started working together in 2008. Base, I think, was when 2006 was when Mr. Kimura brought me with him back to Sacramento to translate and assist. That was the third year of my apprenticeship. Scott Elser was there with Engelmann spruce you had collected. And I said, who collected this? But the legend of the man from Oregon started for me back when I was in college because I was collecting trees out of the Sierras. And I was going up to El Dorado Bonsai outside of Sacramento. And I remember opening my truck up one morning with some fresh collected stock that I had brought up there because they kept it. I was down on the coast and the alpine material wouldn't survive. And they said, have you heard about this guy from Oregon? And I just remember thinking, son of a gun, some guy's out there in the Rockies, my home territory, stealing my material. I got to go find that guy and bury him, which is like the way, you know, like absolutely not going to happen. And I recognize now it would have worked the opposite way. And what I've come to realize in my latter years, post-teen years, is that I have no entitlement to that material. Every collector stakes their grounded, but it's nobody's material, right? But anyways, they were talking about the crazy things you were collecting. And so then when I saw Scott's material in 2006, I was like, holy cow. And Scott Elser was like, you don't know about Randy. I said, no, that was when I went back to Japan and looked at your website and saw the tree in the box on the corner of your driveway that Brent Walston was really worked up about and reached out to you. And that was the beginning of our relationship. Which was pretty interesting to find each other at that moment. And then you ended up coming to Japan on a trip to see the Kokufu. And we went and had yakiniku. And that was the first time that I'd ever met you.
It feels like 2008.
2008, yeah. Yeah.
That was about the time I was starting to get a handle on collecting the Rocky Mountain junipers.
Ah.
Before that, it was primarily ponderosas, lodgepoles. Ponderosas are my favorite, by the way. But Rocky Mountain junipers, trained to collect those, that is, anybody that's ever spent time collecting different species, to collect those consistently is just difficult.
Mm.
The success is so low. You cover so much ground. You wear boots out. You wear trucks out. But anyway, so you hit me at a time when I think people are going to, I will always think of you as the Rocky Mountain juniper guy, the first guy that came around that styled these, repotted them, kept them alive. Now, that's 10 years roughly since you, because you came out about once a year at around Christmas time.
Yeah.
And you'd stay at my place and work for a few days.
Yeah.
However much time you could scratch together.
Yeah.
You would work on trees that either I had or you'd already purchased and got your hand on it. So in 10 years, a lot has changed.
A lot has changed. Because at that time, this is my recollection of it anyways, I remember reaching out to you via email and saying, hey, awesome. And you... I actually still have the email you responded saying, you caught me too late. I'm done collecting trees. I'll collect for myself, but there's no money to be made in this. Cause I think at that point, everybody was a little bit anti Rocky Mountain, didn't know how to handle them. And I think you were probably being, the bartering and the bargaining, for the effort that you were putting in. You weren't seeing the ability to get, to be able to do it and sustain it as a livelihood.
Interesting. I don't actually remember that conversation, but I remember the thoughts that I was having.
Yeah.
I do remember just busting my ass trip after trip and, you know, simply people wouldn't pay.
Yeah.
And we still struggle with that. I understand it. It's a little bit like a fish in an aquarium. It's something that might die and you really got to be bought into it, an expensive tree.
Yeah.
And then you get multiple trees and you've got kids in school and you got wives and you got bills in life. And so that really kind of fits into the separation of whether it's a hobby or whether you want to be more than a hobbyist.
Yeah.
But that's actually kind of a cool thought because I remember at the time being really broken down about the Rocky Mountain junipers. It's what everybody wanted, but they simply wouldn't pay anymore.
Yeah.
And for every Rocky Mountain juniper you can get, you can go out and get 10 ponderosas. Mm-hmm. And the ponderosas almost never die.
Mm-hmm.
The Rockies, you have to leave dozens of trees on the mountain. They're just not quite right, root-wise.
So when you say the success is low, I mean, you historically have had an astronomical success rate. I mean, we're talking high 80s, low 90% success rate as an average for you. And when you say the success is low, I'm assuming you're speaking more to the idea of the number of trees that you find that you can actually safely and successfully collect, the distance you got to put on, the numbers that you have to actually see till you find one that's removable.
Yeah, that would be exactly right. Because you got to remember that I'm trying to do this for a living.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, you've got to make a decision about whether this is commercially successful.
Mm-hmm.
Pines, spruces, most of the varieties out there it is. Junipers, not so much.
Mm.
Yeah. So now We're broaching on an area that's probably very sensitive to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Should somebody be able to make a living doing this?
Mm.
I think that's one of the questions. Is that something you're broaching?
I'm not. I don't want to push you into uncomfortable grounds at all. But I think one of the things, because we have to wrestle with this at Bonsai Mirai, and that when we approach Bonsai, the concept of sustainability, you know, one of the areas that the group touched on is seeing the bonsai process is a lot like seeing the cattle get the cow get slaughtered. Everybody's fine with eating the steak, but the process of the animal going through everything that it has to go through to become that steak that we eat, that is what we're all sheltered from. And there's a process to from the collection to the bending and styling and manipulation, and everybody sees that. They see a bonsai tree and they say, wow, that's beautiful and that's peaceful and that's serene. And then they see the process and they start to have this counter reaction to it, like you're torturing trees, you're doing something horrific. They're fine seeing the finished product. The process really bothers them. And one of the things that I think has forever or at least I try as hard as I can to maintain an upstanding approach from, is supporting people that do it sustainably. And sustainably in my mind is a high success rate and a respect for the ground that the trees are being collected on. And I don't know another collector, number one, that has the success rate that you have, or number two, that respects the land as much as you do. And so I don't want to approach a subject that that makes you uncomfortable, but I also think one of the things that I am proud of in working together so closely with you is the manner in which you handle the collected material, because you pass by an astronomical number of trees that I think other people would rip out of the ground without considering the tree's survivability, and it makes you different.
Thank you. So multiple things. I tend to think out loud. Mm-hmm. This will probably come across very clearly by the end of the podcast, people that don't know me. To step back a little bit, where I was struggling when you first met me with the Rocky Mountain Junipers was that's where the demand was. And I just went out there and literally got my ass handed to me day after day. I remember some of those early trips when I tried to focus on it. I'd be out there for, I don't know, 2 weeks, and I might get 60 trees. That's not possible to make a living at that. And I was just overwhelmed with ponderosas. I couldn't sell them. I'd flooded the market. I only had a few customers about more than one or two trees. So in many respects, about the time that you and I first met, you were the first one to really give me positive feedback and say, you know, I think there's a future here. This is what I'm interested in. This is what you can do. Why don't you come visit me in Japan if you can? And so I think it was only about a year later that I was there, really.
Right.
Just before that, I went to Nolanders too. And so it was the first time I'd really gotten out of the country and seen the Europeans aspect of style collected Yamadori. So in about an 8-month window, my whole world changed. I saw what other people were doing, what could be done, and seeing those kind of trees on two different continents that were styled, were collected, the variety, the sizes, what could be done, was just really, really eye-opening. That was probably that in conjunction with the economic meltdown, because I really was making my living as a landscaper, building koi ponds and water gardens. Mm-hmm. The trees were for fun, and I made a little bit of money on them. But I also cut 100 cords of firewood every winter, too. So I had a lot going on, and trees were my passion. Mm-hmm. I used to hunt animals, big game, a lot. I still do. Tree collecting is a lot like it's a hunt. It's mm-hmm. a treasure hunt for me. So it's passionate for me, and that's what causes me to walk an extra mile, mm-hmm. you know, day after day. Troy's in the room. He's been in the mountains a little mm-hmm. bit. He knows.
Yeah, it is a hunt.
After a few days, you know, especially if you're getting your ass handed to you, because you don't always have good days.
What do you mean by that? Just walking forever, not seeing anything?
Yeah.
Like, or seeing stuff that's not, you're not able, you got to pass it up.
In juniper country, one of the things, this dovetails nicely into the success rate. You'll get into honey holes where you might get 4 or 5 trees out, and then you'll walk for the next 6 hours of the day and a half, and you'll cover roughly 10 miles a day. Your uphills, it's always up. it's always up. And, you just walk by endless amounts of trees. Let's say that you see 1,000 trees in a day. You actually see way more than that. But 1,000 bonsai-sized trees. There's 100 that are good. There's 10 that you can collect. And of the 10 that are collectible, 3 of them are good, 3 are junk, and 3, that's a lie. One is really good. 2 or 3 are pretty good in that they're saleable, they're affordable, you can make something with them. And then there's 5 or 6 in there that are just, they're firewood. Mm. mm-hmm. So the key to success with this is walking by trees that you can't collect successfully. The roots are too small, they're too far away. Nobody's really going to know what to do with it. Too big is a recurring theme. Shoheen.
It's probably
almost
hard.
Impossible to
find. Do you ever lose your sense of scale out there? Since, you know, I notice when I'm out in the forest, since these tiny trees are surrounded by a lot bigger trees, how do you, do you ever pull something out and you're like, oh, wait, that was way too big. That's not.
Oh, yes. Have,
that might have happened just recently. My son collected on three trips with me last year, and we were in Pine Country primarily, and he's 24, and he's in good shape, and he has no real sense of scale and what's going to sell, so he'll lure me off to these trees that are 7 and 8 feet tall and weigh 200 pounds, and say, look at this one, it wiggles, we can get it, and I'll look at Haven, and I'll say, what the, jeez, yeah, that's a tree, all right, let's look a little bit more. Anyway, we ended up bringing like 14 trees that were over 6 feet tall and over 200 pounds back this year. In September and October.
Mm. How so, do you carry?
Yeah, we do sometimes collect stuff that's on the large end.
How do you carry those out?
There were two that we carried out this year. He on one end and me on the other.
Ah, whoa.
So that's the first time that we've ever done that. In the past, I've collected trees like this, but I have to drag them.
Mm.
So a whole lot of things have to come together to drag a tree out of the woods and have the dirt separate and limbs break and all that. That's only happened, I'm going to say, three or four times that I was able to successfully drag a tree out. But to get back to the original question is, you just got to put time on the rock. And the more you do it, it doesn't matter what you do, the more time you do at it, spend at it, the better you're going to get. You're going to glass the side of a mountain. And you just kind of instinctively know where you should go.
Mm.
But, you know, a certain percentage of the time you get there, and that was just bad luck, total loss. So then, but you're up there. You're a mile and a half from the truck. It's a little white spot or a red spot, whatever the truck is of the year. You can look at it down there and say, crap, I got like one scrawny little tree on my back. And you don't want to go uphill any more than you need to, so you just start fanning out. So that's kind of where you learn how to look for that one tree that's going to come out that day that's great. But what, two trees a day is not a living. It's not even remotely close to a living. So you need to average 10 or 15 trees a day. So now you start to put your experience and whatever your sense is, that's going to put trees on your back that are going to have a good root ball, that's going to get you back to the truck so you can get a good night's sleep and dinner again, because tomorrow you're going to do it again, and then the next day again. And the mountains are surprisingly difficult to read sometimes. You'll look for patterns that work several times in a row, and then that pattern goes away. It doesn't exist anymore. Mm. The side of the mountain, the slope, the terrain, the wind, where does water pool? But also that's part of the hunt, right?
Wow.
That's what keeps you going again. When you get blisters on your feet and you're sore and your fingers are bleeding, cactus thorns.
Mm.
There's all sorts of little jewels.
That's what keeps Randy Knight going, not the normal human being. Special cat.
Those are the jewels.
It is. I mean, it's the thrill of success, right? I'm really just competing against myself, but we compete against ourselves in everything all day.
Mm. Of course.
At the end of the day, we really only answer to ourselves in reality.
Yeah.
Finding trees and being good at it, that is the sport for me. You know, I can wire trees and pot trees and style trees, not at the level that gets done up here, but adequately.
You're good. You're good.
But that's not where my niche is in the bonsai world. Clearly, several years ago, I found the right niche, and I'm pretty happy with it. I'm not as young as I used to be, but every year it's, what is it now? It's the end of February. Already I can tell that this year the season isn't going to get started for me until probably middle May, but I can already taste it. I'm semi-retired though now, right? I really just work in the spring and the fall, and in the winter I screw around.
Did you used to go out in the winter?
Yes. I have tried the winter. It's bad, very bad. But you can go to warmer places. But ultimately, that's going to lead you to California.
Yeah.
That's a tough mark. That's tough living. It doesn't make sense for me to be there. Mm. I've tried it before. They do have different varieties down there and different rock and different permit processes. But I don't care about that state really. I like the Rocky Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
I like parts of Canada too, but Canada is just a whole nother set of projects, boats, roads, access, borders, USDA. Yeah. Although this is doable, but it's just more difficult. And at the end of the day, to go up there, to go to Alaska or some of these other far-flung places, it would just be an adventure hunt, which I'm all about. But again, we're talking about winter, and that's just a no-go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I mean, you know, coming back to the commercial aspect of it, you know, I think where I feel a lot of comfort and where I feel a lot of, I think, necessity to talk about that is from the perspective of, you know, obviously the practice of collecting is it's a loaded subject. And my feeling is why wouldn't you support somebody like yourself who is capable of doing it at such a high level, success and respect, and knowledge, just everything that you've built, your passion supporting you in having success with that. And when you think about it from the morality of it, supporting somebody who can do it better than anybody else. I mean, it's going to be done. It's an inherent part of our art form. There are a lot of places where these trees are not valued, you know, by the Forest Service, by, you know, potentially people that are using the land for other uses. And so, you know, where the commercial, when you put commercial into the discussion, all of a sudden it raises everybody's ears, you know, they perk up and it makes a lot of people want to speak of the controversy and stuff. And it goes back to the idea of people, you know, eating beef. It feels the same for me, from the perspective of people don't want to see that process, but they're happy to eat a steak. I mean, people don't want to think about the process of collecting, yet they're happy to do bonsai. You know, where these bonsai come from, Japanese, well, the Japanese bonsai are different. They're not. It's the same way that Japanese bonsai started and got where it's at. Those trees were collected, same way Europe got where it's at, same way China got where it's at, or Korea got where it's at in terms of their bonsai culture. And there are people that simply do it better with a higher success rate and more proficiency, and you're at the top of the heap for that, you know. And so And it's interesting to see the skill set that that serendipitously came together to make you as capable as you are. Because like you said, you were a hunter. You also were a landscaper that worked with a lot of rock, making koi ponds and landscaping and stuff. And these skill sets, you know, along with the grit of cutting 100 cords of wood a winter. I mean, like, you've done a lot of things that make you who you are and give you the capacity to be as successful and prominent of a collector as you are. I think, I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Mm. Probably, but I don't think the skill set that I have is the only one that could lead you to be where I'm at. That just happens to be my background.
Mm.
I remember several times you and I speak, we used to speak a lot more. Your life is far busier now, so we don't shoot the shit as much as we used to. But I remember sharing the analogy with you that the next really good collector, and I feel that I'm pretty good at what I do. I have to be careful because I'm prone to make bold statements that become lightning rods. So, and we'll talk a little bit more about the commercial aspect of collecting if you want. That is absolutely a lightning rod. I very seldom get good feedback from that. It's like being an HR guy. People don't come to see you unless there's a problem.
Yeah.
Or they got a chip on their shoulder or something about it doesn't sit well with them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty opinionated on that by the way, towards the other extreme, but, I'm getting away from the question.
No, I don't have a question about, I don't want to walk you into a corner and take you into uncomfortable ground at all. I just wanted to make the statement that my stance.
Oh yeah.
My stance on that subject is that if you are going to do bonsai and work with a Yamadori, why would you not support somebody who has such a high success rate and is willing to put in the miles to not tear trees out of the ground that don't have the capacities to survive, and somebody who returns the land to a position where you can't see that they've been there? Like, all of the check marks for people are going to eat meat, a cow is going to be slaughtered, people are going to do bonsai, trees are going to be collected. I'm going to support the guy that does it well. And as far as the commercial lightning rod that exists there, my way of finding sustainability in that is supporting the people that just simply do it better. And you are that guy. For Bonsai Mirai, we've symbiotically grown together. You walk through Bonsai Mirai, and the trees that we have in the garden are largely, you know, they're largely a reflection of your career as a collector. Mm. You know, to a degree.
Yeah, I agree.
I think we need to add something here as far as, you know, supporting Randy and collectors that collect trees sustainably, right? For that individual that wants to collect it themselves, right? It reminds me of the time when we first bought our house in Sacramento that, you know, you'd see the signs out in front where it says for sale by owner. And so I asked my realtor about that. You know, what's the story with the for sale by owner? It's just some Yahoo that thinks they can just sell a house, you know? They don't really know the whole process, but they'll muddle through it and, you know, and do their thing, right? So, and he says basically Americans want to do it themselves. You know, it's like they want to do their own taxes. They want to sell their own house. They want to sell their own car and things like that. So I think about this as far as collecting, too. You got that person out there that wants to collect their own trees. And eventually, you know, we all really got into collecting trees because it got to the point where I couldn't really afford to buy a tree. I could put that money into the collecting trip, you know, go out there and try to experience the whole moment, right? But I think that person that wants to for sale by, you know, by owner should understand if you're going to do that, and this is my comment here, if you're going to do that, learn how to do it right. Mm-hmm. So that you're not going out there destroying the land, killing these trees, and just, you know,
well,
take the time.
How do you learn how to do it right when everyone's so secretive about it?
Well, I think there's some information on the internet that, you know, they can find out for themselves. I'm not going to present my methods, but
right.
They can do that. So
right.
Just like I had to learn, they can learn too.
Another thing, start small. Don't go out there trying to grab a trophy. Grab something simple and
well, that's hard to say because if that trophy is presented to you, boy.
Well, that's the skill, walking away. You got to walk away.
Well, but I think I'm not trying to walk this conversation into a trap. And Randy and I talked about him coming up and talking with us at Mirai. And he said, listen, man, the conversation of me as a collector and this whole, you know, it's dangerous. And I understand and respect that. And I know that you have your opinions about it that, you know, all of us do. And this is the conversation that we entered with Bonsai being sustainable and ethical. But I think one thing that needs to be said along with that, Troy, is the cost that a lot of people go through to go do it themselves. They end up recognizing, oh man, I just spent X amount of dollars getting there. I spent X amount of days trying to find it, and whatever I collected died. And in all actuality, you would have been far better off paying for a nice piece of material from a collector who does it better with a higher success rate and is more respectful to the land and the process than trying to go do it yourself. You know, there's a whole list of bonsai things you do yourself. I think the entitlement to doing it ourselves, or, you know, maybe entitlement is a loaded word as well. There is a freedom that exists in the United States, and that's great. It doesn't change the discussion in my mind, and that is there are people like Randy who have focused. He's talking about 17 or 18 years of being a professional collector, always having had a high success rate, but perfecting that skill set to now. Randy knows if he's going to have success or not with the tree, and that plays into his judgment on the rock. I want to support that. I want to support that guy who's put in that time, who cares about where he's going and the land that he's going to. And I think, you know, you talking about the Rockies, I mean, I think you love the Rocky Mountains. That's you cherish that land. And yeah, in order to do it and do it well, there is a commercial aspect to it. Just the same as, look, I love bonsai. I want to do bonsai well. That means that I have to sell bonsai trees. and any art form where you where people there's a an ability to reach a high level of skill set and a really high level of pursuit, somebody has to do it a lot. It's not a thing that you just pick up and you're like, oh, I'm just naturally good at it. You have to do it a lot. You've got to succeed. You've got to fail. You've got to work it and work it and work it and obsess about it and think about it and come back to the drawing board over and over and over again. And all of those experiences make you who you are. I'm going to support that guy. I'm going to support that guy that's put in that time or girl, you know, that person who has put in that time and effort and really gone the extra mile to be able to do it extremely well. And I think that there's nobody else in the world that I know of that has put in the kind of time beyond just the doing, the time and the research, the knowledge, the way that you handle the root systems afterwards, the soil that you use and the time that you put into potting and the overall approach that you take to the care of the trees. And it's amazing. People don't understand what you do to ensure that these trees get the attention that they need and that the respect is paid to the material. So I really envy that on all levels. And for us, I think we have the same approach to once we have a piece of material, we owe it to that material to mm-hmm. really do whatever it takes beyond what's comfortable to us to make sure that that material thrives. It is a living thing. And it's a part of it to see this medium be capable of being a vehicle to discuss bigger issues and explore aspects of art that make art valuable in society, you know, and this is a part of our art form that I think a lot of people have misconceptions about. So anyways, I'm going to get off the soapbox, but I do want to go back to your skill set, you know, the things that led up to you being able to put together. You say you don't feel it's unique to you. I feel it is unique to you. I really do. And I appreciate your humility and the humble approach that you take to what makes Randy Knight successful. But look, you have multiple characteristics that make you the best collector in the world.
Thank you. That kind of leads back to where I lost track of things earlier when I said that I've shared the analogy with you several times that the next guy to come along that really takes the collecting world to the next level. There's always another level, right? He's not going to be a bonsai enthusiast. He's going to be a mountain guide, probably a rancher, a rancher's kid. He probably fishes and hunts and takes guys out hunting for a living in the winter, or, you know, during the hunting seasons. And he's probably going to come somewhere from some smaller town in the Midwest, I would guess. Not Midwest, Rocky Mountains, Montana maybe. Doesn't really matter. But he's going to come with a skill set like mine, but it's going to be different. My skill set did set me up for this, but there's dozens of other, you know, skill sets in somebody else's background, put them in the same place. And the next guy or person, the next person to come along that does this well, he's going to be set up with a varied background, and it's just going to turn out that once he finds out about bonsai or gets the bug or the passion or whatever lights his fire to do this, he's just going to have some similar background. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That is going to allow him to be successful in the mountains. One of the skill sets that I probably can't overestimate enough. That's a lie. I'm biased. I don't really know. But being comfortable alone in the mountains is huge. When you're alone, you have this... the ability to kind of lose track of what's going on. I've heard you say, is a similar analogy, that when you get in the wiring zone or the styling zone, time just flies. Next thing you know, it's like 6 hours. You haven't eaten. It's like, what happened?
Yeah.
Same thing in the mountains. When you don't have to worry about somebody else. You don't have to worry about time frame. You have morning. You have dark. You want to be off the rock sometime near dark. Yeah, that's really how the day goes, right? You get out there pretty soon. Sometimes you find yourself 4 miles from the truck, and it's dark in 15 minutes. Like, crap, what have I done? But at the same time, you were probably on a plane. You were chasing something, and almost always you're coming back at dark like that. I actually come back after dark. I like to finish at dark on the mountain and come down. I don't know why. It reminds me of when I was a kid hunting deer with my father.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, you come down with the pack and it's 100, 150 pounds, and you're trying to figure out the best way to get back to the truck. And when I think back, you said a couple things that caused me to think about some of these instances. You lost time. You lost track of time, but you were out there because you were having fun. You were doing what you love.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is one of the things that works really well for me. That's one of the things that's going to work really well for the next person too. And I may be at the top of the game right now. Hopefully it lasts for another 10 or 15 years. Who can say? I'll never retire from this. When I'm 75, I'll still be out there with my walker shuffling along. Looking at the next patch of prickly pear and trying to decide whether the rollers will go through it or not. Or if I have to go around. But there will be another person, and the next person will be equally respectful of the resource. It's a limited resource.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that only... It may not be limited if you had a helicopter or a drone that could pick you up and take you down. You could collect trees and come back. But mountain ranges, by their very nature, are serrated and the roads don't go everywhere. And there are no trails. The only trail that I ever see is a game trail or a cattle path. You almost never use a cattle path unless it's in the sage. And that really is just the access from your truck to the rock. So... Yeah, I'm wandering in my thoughts right now.
It's great. It's great. I mean, I think the mountains for you are your flow state, more or less.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're out there, you are in that frame of mind that is sort of a higher level of sort of mental function, more or less.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting. I mean, because you know, obviously, you and I talk about and have, you know, yeah. Life has gotten busy. I miss talking with you about your collecting trips a lot, but you know, you'll always come back with a story of rattlesnakes or critters on the mountain that are trying to get you, or cactus or something like that. And where I think that is a deterrent, you really embrace those situations. I don't quite understand how. You have a very famous picture of a rattlesnake trying to strike at your crotch. That I think is impressive that you chose to take a picture at that moment as opposed to what most people would do, which is run.
I might have shrieked.
Yeah. If you shriek in the mountains, does anybody hear it? Right?
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, and again, that all of that bundles and ties into sort of Randy Knight as the individual that's capable of doing what you're doing. But... You know, one of the other things that has had a big influence on me in terms of our relationship is I'll never forget, you know, Mirai, the first night I spent in the house, rain comes pouring through the roof, and I'm just thinking, what have I done? You know, and I talked to you the next day, and you're like, well, did you fix it? And I was like, I don't know what to do. And you're like, well, what do you mean you don't know what to do? Go patch the hole. Like, that's what you do. And I was like, oh, okay. And then, you know, the first time you helped me set the very first stone in the garden, and you know, it looked like this massive boulder, and there's this crane setting this stone, and I just remember turning and looking at you and going, it's gonna take a lot of rocks. And you're like, yeah it is. But what's the big deal? Like, quit being such a baby about it, just go get rocks. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, you helped me stack the first stone wall at Mirai, and I'm like, man, this is going to take forever. And you're like, sure, yeah, what else are you going to be doing? Like, isn't this what you said you're going to do? Build a bonsai garden? Like, this is what it looks like. And I think that mentality of you do it, you figure it out. It was almost like the one step at a time to get up to the mountain, and the one tree at a time that it took to build Mirai, and for you, I think, to build you as a collector and stuff. That was a mentality that you have always had as an individual, where the limitation never really has not seemed daunting to you.
That's kind of interesting. I was just having some thoughts while you were saying that. When I come back from the mountain, I do have those stories, but really they're about overcoming adversity, right? How did I solve the problem? I know what my goal is. At the end of the day, I know where I want to be with collecting trees, doing it well. Well, I like to do things well. I like to be successful. So how do you do that? You persevere.
Mm-hmm.
You look at these things not really as setbacks, but more like, huh, it's just another little roadblock. How do I deal with it? What's the easiest way around this? So when I come back, people see the trees that I get. And, you know, when we unload the trailer and the truck, and you've got a class here, it's always an event. And as we unload those things, it's really the stories of adversity that people want to hear. That's a better story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just walked out I drove to the end of the road, and I got out of the truck, and I got 30 trees right here. And look at them. Holy, that would not be epic. That would not be an event. That would just be common sense. That'd be like going to the shoe store and going through a rack of running shoes and picking your favorite color.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's no sense of adventure there. That's not life. That's that's kind of boring and mundane, really.
And not a reality either, right? I mean, you put on the miles not because you want to, because you have to. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's 1,200 miles from here to the Rocky Mountains. It's a 24-hour drive, roughly. You do that going, you collect your trees, you do that coming back, and then you get a week to 10 days of planting trees. It's a project. You got to be, if I didn't love this, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
That's clear.
Yeah.
And pretty much any business, look at your statement about, it's going to take a lot of rocks. It probably took more than you think even, and you could still use more.
Far more. Far more, and we could do with more rock.
Almost every process is more involved than you think, and you wouldn't be doing this if you didn't buy into this and this wasn't your passion, it wasn't your dream. We haven't talked in a while, so I don't know where you think this is going to be next year, 5 years or 10 years, or where you're going to be in 30 years when you're my age.
Right.
Who can say? And whatever plans you have for that, surely they'll be different when you get there.
Yeah.
But that's part of the joy of working for yourself, having your own business, is being able to change your mind. Sometimes it's hard to let go of ideas that you think about and get real passionate about. And I'm running on a tangent here, but the same thing happens when you're in the mountains. Some days you'll just get a wild hair. You'll have been doing good somewhere, and you'll change your mind. You'll wind up the next morning 80 miles away in a completely different face.
Mm.
And some days it goes well. Some days it doesn't. Some days you change. Some days you move 200 miles overnight because of snow, especially in the spring. But I like October, November are two of my favorite months for collecting. Snow, rain, mud. There's any manner of things that can change your day. Mm. Sometimes they're for good reason. Sometimes they're bad reason. Some days you're just frustrated for God knows what. Here's what happens a lot. You get up in the morning, you got a flat tire, and things don't go well. And the next thing you know, it's 2 p.m, and the closest rock is still 60 miles away, and you're trying to decide, where can I get 4 trees between now and dark? And it's dark at 6.
Yeah.
So, you know, fortunately, you're not bound to a certain spot every day. You just grab the reins and you look at, how am I going to make today a success? This fits back into the adversity thing. The challenge. I think most people, if they work for themselves, especially, people can embrace a challenge. Nobody looks for ones that are pointless or there's no way to solve them or make things come out with your glass half full or better. But being able to do that's part of the reason that you and I do what we do.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why we struggle.
Yeah.
Your struggles this year are probably going to be a little bit different than next year. And you probably have no idea what the real struggles are going to be 5 years from now. So even though I work on the rock and make my living on the rock, I see what you guys do here. It's completely different end of things, but it's all related. I mean, it's still in the same file folder, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I do appreciate that you support me and respect pretty much what I do. Actually, I know you do. So that also is one of many things that caused me to get work to get better. Because I work slower now, and I can't carry as much weight as I used to, or I prefer not to.
Yeah.
But I still want to be successful, and I'm not that interested in relinquishing what I do now to somebody else.
Yeah.
Like you.
Sure.
Seeing somebody come along that's going to do a better job than me, that's more efficient and kicks my ass, it's going to happen. It happens to every person in the world, right? That's not something that you embrace. It's like, no, I'm going to kick that dude's ass.
Yeah.
He thinks he's going to catch up, but he doesn't have a chance.
Yeah.
And that just comes with, for me, with age, hopefully some wisdom and experience.
Mm-hmm.
Experience, really, right?
Yeah.
In the real world, I don't think that I'm losing my mind, but I probably have forgotten important things about collecting. And maybe this year I'll remember them again. That's actually a real thing. Mm. You'll find yourself in a position somewhere and it's like, God, this is familiar. What's going on? It's like, oh. And you won't remember the tree, but you remember what you did with your tool or how you moved a rock or, yeah.
Yeah. Pulling on the bag of tricks. Do you have fear out there ever? Is fear something? And has that changed as you've gotten older, or your time in the mountains has progressed?
Yes. Hell yes, I have fear out there occasionally.
Which has happened?
Hang on just a second.
Oh. If you, go for it, man.
So, yeah. I got to take a break, then we'll talk about fear.
Yeah, go do your thing. It's interesting catching back up with Randy in the limited amount of time that we get to, Troy and I talk about it a lot just because Randy's impact on Mariah has been significant.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the trees that are in the garden are a huge reflection of Randy, but I think the mentality at Mariah is a big reflection of Randy as well. Like he took limitation out of the equation, mental limitation. And that's one thing that I see when you see the trees he collects and you see the success rate and the quality, you just recognize that this is a person that is finding solutions to the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're seeing his touch on the trees because, he's out there collecting these trees. He sees this one tree. I'm like, I like that tree. We get that tree from him. So we're seeing his, his touch throughout the whole way.
Yep.
And so he does have some influence in what's being done here.
And his aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, aesthetic. Yeah.
Every collector is going to find different value in different trees. And, when Randy and I originally started working together, he would say, why do you think, what's good, what's bad, what adds value to a tree? I mean, I remember Randy and I spending in the first few years at Mirai, and even when I was still in Japan coming back, one thing that Randy always was really communicative about was wanting feedback on what is it that makes a bonsai good? What is it that makes a bonsai great? And I think, coming back to your point, Kendall, where you're like, look, you're a small person in big mountains and the scale of the mountains and the scale of the trees starts to change. How do you keep your bearings? One of the things that I think has always impressed me about Randy is his ability to find and identify quality with that lack of scale and that lack of perspective in the mountains. And I think that's as much a learned and focused on skill set as any other aspect of the collecting process is being able to pick.
So we were going to talk about fear.
Fear. Randy's back. Fear.
So I took a little break here, dealt with some stuff. Fear. So fear is very unpredictable and it's variable. Taking the break, I realized that I had my two biggest fears last year was when I had my son with me. One night we'd been collecting spruce. We were over 10,000 feet. It was August, but it was raining. It was cold. We were underprepared for that, the shift in the weather. And we came back and the GPS failed. I kind of knew where we needed to be, but I trusted the GPS. And it's one of the two times I've had one where it simply didn't work. It took us the wrong way. And I thought we were going to have to spend the night out there, which wasn't going to be a deal breaker, but it was only a second or third trip. And I knew that by morning, after shivering out there all night, and we'd have got a fire going and everything. It's going to be like, he's not going to be that interested in collecting with me anymore. This is going to be, this could be a real deal breaker for most people. It would be. And I remember being really afraid that I was going to lead him into a bad experience. And it turned out that we set our packs down. They were super heavy. We walked to the top of the closest mountain, and we figured out where the road was, saw where the GPS had gone wrong, and we left everything and booked straight out. And we got out to the road after dark, and the next day we went back and found our gear, and it was all okay. That was a different kind of fear than the kind that typically happens on the mountains. Mm-hmm. This was one where your mind had time to think and react, and there were repercussions. The fear that you mostly experience happens immediately and quickly. Accidents, near accidents. I have a great story about leaping across a crevasse. I'm sure I've shared it with you. I was in the pine country, and this has probably been, probably 8 years ago. I had a backpack of trees on. They didn't weigh much, maybe 50, 60 pounds, but one of them stuck up over the back of my head about 3 feet. There's big trees, right? And so I come to a crevasse, and it's only about 3 feet across, maybe a little wider, but it's about 20 feet deep. Mm. And I think, well, I'm not going to walk clear around. That's like 80 yards. I'm just going to jump it. The ground was dry, no big deal. And so I ducked down under an overhanging limb and leap, and the top of the tree catches that overhanging limb. And so as I'm jumping across the crevasse, my feet are moving ahead. My upper shoulders are staying vertical. And I realized that this is going wrong very quickly. And it worked out. I landed in a heap on the other side, and I didn't fall in the hole. But you get a little shaky, and then you feel like you've been sucking on a rusty nail for a little bit, and your breath might be a little ragged, and you've got blood pressure spikes.
Yeah, right. A little adrenaline jolt.
Have you ever
there.
Had any accidents out
that's,
there?
That was a fear.
Where you get hurt, and you're like, oh, shit.
I haven't been hurt bad. I get hurt almost every trip in some way. Fingers, usually. I've taken some nasty spills. I hurt my shoulder bad once. I hurt my knee once. Both times it took about a year to recover. Yeah, I mean, you keep doing what you do. It just takes a while for things to get tight again. So knock on wood, I have not been hurt. Broken fingertips, smashed knuckles, things like that.
Big cuts.
A lot of cuts.
You talked to me one time about you had a real heavy pack on. You took a nosedive, and the weight of the pack almost smashed your head into the rock. There were a couple times where you're like, I was within inches of being basically bludgeoned by the pack or the trees on the rock. And I remember thinking about that, just going, there is a strong chance that somebody will find the remains of Randy Knight in the mountains at some point, you know, where we don't hear from you, you don't come back, and then... And there's a skeletal remain in the mountains with trees, you know, over these bones somewhere.
Hopefully not this year. Yeah, so the pack thing, that's happened twice where I've, and both times I've had a loaded pack, and you're walking and you're in the forest and you pick up one of your feet and it just perfectly coincides with that 12 to an 18 inch stob. It gets stuck between the ground and the toe of your boot, and and you're moving fast. I cover ground quickly. There's really, most of the time, there's no recovery from that, and you lose your balance. You wouldn't think this is a real thing, but it's happened twice, and I've had close calls with it. So you lose your balance. You go down. Fortunately, you usually go down forward. You toss your tool, and as you hit the ground, you know kind of what's coming because you bounce. About the time you come up off the ground, about 3 inches, then about 80 to 100 pounds, whatever is on your back.
Right.
And the heavier it is, the more likely you're to go down. Then that hits you and it pushes your face into the dirt too. And there's really no, that just happens really quick. There might be a little bit of fear there, but it's pretty brief.
Done that. Yeah, not fun.
And then you just blow some dust out of your nose and try not to cry. But again, there's usually nobody to see.
How often does your pug Poppy come with you on your collecting trips?
Poppy made 6 of the 7 collecting trips last year.
That's amazing.
A mountain pug.
Wow.
13-year-old mountain pug.
Yeah, she was 12 last year, and she stays in good shape just like me. Her ideal...
She's the fittest pug I've ever seen.
...would be to eat and sleep and use it or lose it, they say. My sister used to say that. Tell that to the people in the nursing homes you worked with. So I make the pug go, and she's going to go this year, too. She's deaf, kind of like me, so we make quite a team out there, especially in the late afternoon. It's getting dark, and she's black, and she's gotten to the point where when I move through the forest, I'm zigging and zagging all the time or anywhere in the rock, and she will sit at a point and not come until she has to. She knows I'm about to disappear, and sometimes that's 200 yards now, and I'll call, and they're stubborn, right? And so she's getting sneaky and clever in her old age about trying to avoid any unnecessary walking.
That's awesome.
That's hilarious.
But yeah. That's awesome. Yeah,
the dog goes.
Poppy the pug.
The next one will too.
Yeah.
You're going to get a puppy?
Hoping to get another puppy.
Wow.
There will be another little black pug, I'm certain.
Peter Warren will be stoked on that.
Peter Warren's going to be pumped for the next Poppy.
Yeah. Poppy 2.0.
Poppy can pass on her wisdom to the puppy.
Poppy is a problem in the summer. I never carry water. I never carry food. I just go with the fanny pack. I have to take water for the pug.
Mm. Yeah, I remember talking to you about
water?
This.
No.
Long ago, you said, you know, I've heard there are mountain climbers, like rock climbers, that the water is too heavy, so they train themselves to not need water. And that's how I handle the mountains. I mean, you've basically conditioned your body to be out there in the manner that you need to be out there. And that means conditioning yourself to not need water as much, correct?
Yeah, that's actually a real thing. I used to do that when I would bow hunt in the 90s. One, it makes noise when it's sloppy, sloshing around. Two, if you want to be able to go hard and fast day after day after day, and that's really still what I do, you need to minimize weight. If you carry a quart of water, that's what, 2 pounds? But if you carry 2 pounds over 10 miles a day over 60 days a year, that's tons.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't carry hardly anything. Last year, for the first time, I took a first aid medical training class. I had some... I wouldn't say it was a dream, but some intuition that I should train myself to take care of a compound fracture on my leg.
Mm.
So now I carry rope and some splinting material and a little stop the blood packet. So I'm evolving.
Wow. Wow.
And I have been known to
wisdom.
Steal some of the pug's water.
Wisdom.
The not carrying water is interesting. I used to do the same when I'd hike. I wouldn't carry much water. And I really only ran into trouble like maybe twice over half a year or something. But it was just too heavy. It was like better use of carrying sunblock or duct tape, honestly, than water. But that
you guys are insane.
This is when you walked across the country?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I would probably go 16 hours a day with maybe just one bottle of water, like through the thing. And your body gets really used to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, when you go to urinate, if you do need to at all, it'll tell you as far as the color goes, what's happening. And that's the only time I got in trouble was like went to go pee and it was brown.
Mm.
It was like kind of setting in renal failure, but that was cool.
Waited a little too long.
Yep. Yep. The desert. That was cool.
Mm.
But no water in the mountains can be done.
So, I mean, you say that your heart really lies in the Rockies, but, I mean, you've had experience in most of the Western mountain ranges, would you say? Just exploring, being in the mountains, and not necessarily collecting trees, but also experience in a wide variety of conditions where you collect in. And, I mean, the Rockies, you love them because they're... because of the species and the presence of trees, or because of the actual landscape? I mean, what is it that draws you to the Rockies, and what other places and have you really enjoyed just from the being present in those locations?
Well, so I've been in every state really except Arizona, with regards to collecting, or at least looking for collecting possibilities. There are several states that I've spent quite a bit of time in looking, and it's just like mountain range after mountain range has got trees. And especially if you were just out for your own, you get a couple of good trees every day, but that's not a way to make this, to do what I do, to be successful at it and make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of on a side note to that is the more ground you see, the more conditions you see, the bigger your bag of tricks and your skill set becomes, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do I make this work? And for me, because I live in Oregon, Northwest Oregon, anytime you start to get more than a couple of days away, that impacts what you're going to collect and how you're going to do it successfully. Because if you do the math, when I leave on one of my trips, the very first tree that I collect, that tree might not get planted for 3 weeks. And when you do that in the end of June and it's 100 degrees, you just have to be on your game. Because,
mm-hmm.
again, this can't work if I'm not successful with high success rates.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you make that happen? It's always evolving. I'm always, you see me always trying new things.
Yeah.
I'll tell you things. What do you think about this? This is what I'm going to try. Or sometimes I just say, a lot of times when I think it's sketchy, I just do it. And then I say, you know, I tried that, didn't work. Or you always hear about the successes.
Mm-hmm.
Trying not to stay static. So I love to see new country. But new country means new permits, new landowners, new maps. And I don't use Google Earth. I know that I'm not really a technology guy.
Mm-hmm.
I like my GPS and I like my binoculars.
Mm.
But beyond that, you need to be on the ground.
Got to be boots on the ground, yeah.
And you can look at trees all day long on Google Earth and see good ones, but you're not going to see the important things is it collectible?
Mm-hmm.
You can find good trees everywhere. And I think people overestimate technology, which I'm pretty cool with because I much prefer paper maps and binoculars and driving and covering ground. And I like to meet people, right? You know, I'll strike up conversations with ranchers, landowners, whoever I think is going to put me in touch with a closer sense of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And we're always talking about mountains, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even in the deserts or the plateaus, you're still looking at rock, basically. You can collect in the dirt, but you need to, if you're a dirt collector, you need to probably be dealing with that tree within 2 days. So for me, that's really a no-go.
Mm-hmm.
And even at that, the time frames that are allowable are much less than the way I do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to work mountain ranges that I've had success in, where I enjoy the people around them.
Mm-hmm.
Your home state has a lot of very unfriendly people.
Yeah.
In fact, that's the greatest number of people that I would call dill holes come from your state.
my state being Colorado.
And that's a real thing. Surprisingly, the people in California, where I thought were going to be, I'd always heard stories, isn't it? They're some of the most embracing people I've ever talked to about collecting trees and where to go and how to find things and saying, yeah, this is my property. Do what you want. Park here, drive there. Do it. I've never really had problems there.
Interesting.
So you never know what you're going to find. And you really need to do your stuff in person, right?
Yeah.
Talking on the phone, that's a good way to get shut down and for people to tell you no at just about every turn.
Yeah.
When you knock on somebody's door, and you're personable and you say hi and you treat them like you'd like to be treated, you'd be surprised how many doors open for you and the leads that develop. One thing I wanted to chat about real briefly was Troy's analogy to the for sale by owner. That's a real thing. That's how I got into this, trying to find trees for myself that I couldn't afford. And then I got good trees that I didn't know what to do with.
Mm-hmm.
You see students come and go through here that want to collect all the time, very same reason. And I can think of half a dozen in the last few years that have gone out and done exactly what you said. And I'm all for people collecting on their own. I think that's a great thing. I think it'll put them in much better touch with what it is they're really, really after. I don't know hardly any of these students that made more than one trip.
Yeah.
So you nailed that on the head, but we've talked about it before, and it's a predictable thing. It's a long way to go. The trees are there, but getting them out of the ground just doesn't happen immediately. I mean, it It just takes time.
Yeah.
And then the success rate. And then invariably they come back and the trees that they did get to survive, when you look at them later on, they'll say, what was I thinking?
Right.
Why did I take that tree? So I'm not trying to discourage anyone. I'm just saying that approach it thoughtfully and be realistic about your time frame and your skill set and your ability to be out there and really give it some thought, because really is project management. I mean, primarily the time, the distance, and what you're willing to sacrifice to make it work.
Hmm.
So
that's interesting. I mean, you were a project manager, interestingly enough. Again, I still go back to your accumulation of skill sets that you so easily sort of pass off as being, oh, anybody, you know, could put this skill set together, and I just disagree. And that's fine. We can disagree on that. I definitely see where you're more capable than anybody else that I've met to do this. But I kind of want to pivot a little bit, because you said you went to the Nolander's Trophy in 2008 or 9, and you came to the Kokfu in 2010. In fact, you helped me schlep a lot of my stuff back from Japan. We toured the Kokfu. We went and looked at a lot of operations in Japan together before I finished my apprenticeship. And, you know, as far as what the, you know, the material that you're collecting and the material that we have access to in the United States compared to what you saw in Europe and what you saw in Japan, I mean, you have any impressions of that in terms of quality or, you know, potential or anything like that? I haven't really talked to you about that in a long time.
Yeah, I do. So I think it was Nolander's 07, and then I was in, I first met you in 08, and then I came back again in 2010.
That's right.
So at Nolander's, that was the first time I'd seen collected trees, and part of that trip was, I have a friend, Walter Paul, and he's the one who enabled me to get to Europe a few times. And he has helped me to meet a lot of the European collectors. And we're going back some years now. I haven't been there in a while. But it was pretty interesting to see their approach. As a side note, it was my impression at the time that the Europeans wanted to go out, collect their own tree, style it, build their own pot, make their own stand, and win Nolander's with it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of that in America, but I see less of it here.
Mm-hmm.
I see more differentiation here. And some of the things you pointed out later on in Japan was, Japan is a very, very niche market. People do their own thing there, and everybody, it all comes together with a whole at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody tries to do it all there. We'll probably enter a time, there's people here that want to do it all.
Mm-hmm.
That would be very tough.
Tough to do it at a high level, for sure.
Yeah, and to produce a winning tree, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you got to have goals, right?
Yeah, sure.
So with regard to Europe, at the end of the day, they don't have the same quality that we do. They're never going to be able to compete. This would be me making a bold statement, perhaps, but it's true. I believe it to be true. I should be the first one to say that I'm opinionated, but I'm pretty willing to change my opinions tomorrow. If you don't do that, you'd just be an idiot, right?
Yeah.
and that's the way we learn and develop and move and evolve forward. But having said that, they have come on strong, and I only know this from looking at pictures in the magazines. Their Sabina junipers seem to have gotten substantially better than they were even 10 years ago.
Yeah.
That feels like a real thing to me. They'll always be at the top end with cork oaks and olives. We'll never compete there.
Right.
But mostly I'm a conifer guy, and most of America seems to be primarily conifers. I used to field grow, as you know, deciduous trees. I'm off on a tangent here. You can't grow field trees and sell them in America and make any kind of money. There's no living to be made. It's just a labor of love. Japan. So when I first went to Japan and I met you, that was actually a very eye-opening trip, by the way. I really wasn't aware that the best trees in Japan were collected trees. We were used to seeing Japanese imports. The Japanese imports that I grew up on, and we still see primarily today, I feel, are field-grown trees.
Yeah.
And they look more or less similar. I mean, there's variations, but subtle. It wasn't until that first trip in 2008 I came away with the realization that the best trees in Japan were collected.
Mm-hmm.
And they were styled, and they've been worked on over a much longer period of time than ours have. You and I talked about that multiple times, but after that first trip to Japan, I came back and I had this newfound sense of there's a future in this for me. Maybe I can do this. Maybe I don't have to be a contractor anymore. I don't need employees.
Right.
Which was a kind of liberating thing for me after a number of years. I'm getting the stink eye here. Not really. I'm just messing. Anyway, I came away from that realizing that I'd been walking by trees in the mountain that I had no idea were bonsai worthy, or that they could be tweaked or bent or manipulated into being a bonsai. And I know that I've shared this story with you, but I had some private ground that I worked in Wyoming. It was pine country. And I'd been there numerous times. And I draw maps of where I collect, where I found things, trees that I couldn't collect, hot spots. And more importantly, I will make a map of the little pockets that I didn't work that I thought might be something in the future. And so I remember I'd been on this mountain and I'd parked in this spot a couple of times before, and I'd collected, let's say, within the radius of this, let's say I'd collected 30 trees, probably within a mile or two. I remember coming back the next year, parking in that same spot and collecting 50 trees that I'd walked by or hadn't understood were bonsai worthy. They were either too big, they were too lank, something about them. I believe that I came back, the 50 trees I collected on the literally the third go-around were better than the 30 I'd collected the first two times.
Mm.
And that was just, I was at a point where that was a real eye-opening experience. All of a sudden, it's like, holy crap, look at what I've been walking by.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, when I'm on the mountain today, I will still see places where people have collected and I'll find great trees, either stuff they couldn't get out or they didn't know was a good tree. I see that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That is a reflection basically of what you do here, and knowing that tree actually can be the angle change, something bent, something shortened, or in some cases long and ungainly, is still beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bonsai. It's just not what in the first 8 years I grew up thinking a bonsai was.
Right. Interesting. That kind of growth. And coming back to your discussion of being a field grower, I mean, I think a lot of people don't know that you were a prolific field grower. I mean, you had when I met you, you had a gigantic field of trees. It was daunting to walk through. And you love that. And you don't necessarily do that now. And you just talked about how field growing is it's a tough go with the time that you have to put in and what comes out of it. Why do you think that is? And do you think you'll field grow again, or?
I would love to field grow again. And between houses now, field growing takes time. And I really don't know. The end of the day, though, people want to buy a finished tree, especially if it's a deciduous tree. Much fewer people there want to buy a raw stock and develop themselves. Probably, my opinion is that's because the process is so much longer. With a lot of the conifers, you can take it on the first styling. All of a sudden, people can see the future of a tree. Some of the limber pines and the Douglas firs almost look nearly finished with a thin crown on the first go. That never happens with a deciduous tree.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to do all the big work in the ground, and then it's got to come into a smaller pot for ramification. And that means you've got to work on it a lot more. You got to spend more time, and people simply won't pay. I had over 20,000 trees in the ground at one time. And I probably never really did much more than break even field growing, but I did love it. I mean, every part of it, the nurturing, you know, starting with little tiny planting pencils, and 10 or 12 years later, you know, you've got some trees that are so big. I would collect them when I cleared that field, I collected it with a backhoe. I think you were out there literally going down row by row, lifting out trees that were just unbelievable. And we ended up burning most of them because some people aren't going to buy a 6-inch a maple that's 30 inches tall with a 6-inch trunk that's raw. It doesn't matter the base, doesn't matter the framework.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a no-go here.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting because you know that everybody, when you said you ended up burning most of them, everybody that's listening, their heart just literally like skipped a beat like, what? You know, but then at the same time, being out at the field with you and watching people go through it, and I think it's really hard when we have this, so much of our bonsai culture is established from seeing pictures of finished trees, and obviously that's what motivates people to get into it. In the process, and I almost think it's the lack of knowledge of the process that impeded people's ability to go through a field and see the value. And that's really unfortunate, because I still would say that your field was the best field in the country for finding the highest quality material. And everybody knows you as a collector. They don't know you as a field grower. And everybody's always looking for material, and material is not readily available and not easy to find. And so it's really interesting to consider that aspect of Randy Knight and
the variety of
sense.
Material.
The variety, yeah, mm-hmm. the yeah. variety. Mm-hmm. And you know what's always interesting about bonsai is, and I think this is universal across the world of everything, when it's gone, everybody wants it back.
Mm-hmm.
But when it was here, nobody cared.
Yeah.
Or maybe they just weren't able to see mm-hmm. what actually was there. You know, and one of the interesting things, too, about Randy's field was that he treated a lot of his field-grown material. His aesthetic was trained by the natural mountainscape and landscape. So his trees had more contortion and similarities to Yamadori than they ever did to what I would consider to be more of that traditional fundamental mm-hmm. form. Mm-hmm. And when you see those trees evolve now, some of the black pines, some of the Zelkovas, the hedge maples that
the
he grew, the hornbeams, the larches.
Oh, the larches, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and you're just like, how did this guy have 20,000 trees in the field? And he's spending, I mean, when he would go in and prune the field every year, you're talking about weeks and weeks of pruning. I mean, he would wear out shears. He would have multiple shears in his hands. He would have to condition his hands to do the pruning in the field before he would get into there. Otherwise, his hands would be broken down after a few days of pruning. Mm-hmm. And you look at all of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, the lack of insight for those ones that walk into those fields, it's just such overwhelming. You have hundreds of trees. It's like, what am I looking at? What's... You know, what is here that I should mm-hmm. dig, right? But I think about the time we went out into Topparian Farms, you know, we had the group of guys that were there that were helping us, right? And it was a big help to them to be able to pull a couple of their own personal trees with your advice and suggestions on some of the material that they might have been looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So they have that confidence level. It's like, oh, okay, we're going to take this tree and we're going to work on this tree.
Well,
but without you being there, it would be like, well, what am I looking at here?
Yeah, and also to see... where I think people that haven't experienced a field, and I have to be really honest, I mean, I cut my teeth in the field, in Randy's field, you know, because I also saw that material, and the larches here at Mirai are a testament to that. Most of the larches at Mirai were grown by Randy and going out into the field. And again, you know, I always go back to Diane Lund. You know, we talked about it in the, what was that, Texas Barbecue podcast, where we talk about how we handle the field
mm-hmm.
and going into a field and finding that really high-level material. Diane Lund was one of the best field pickers in terms of going in and seeing the value in that field-grown tree. You used to always say that Diane was just phenomenally talented at that aspect of, she worked a field better than anybody.
I was stepped out for a minute, but that's interesting because when I left here a bit ago, my first thought was people would come to the field and get overwhelmed, professionals even. I remember, well, you've seen it, too many choices, too many trees, but Diane did the best job of picking field-grown trees of anybody, and she did it consistently. She just had an eye for it.
Yeah.
Almost nobody else did anywhere, even remotely close. It makes me kind of chuckle because I remember several times having people come through that really should have known better, pick some trees, and later on we'd go through and I'd look at the tags and walk through with them and say, don't look at that tree. Don't look at this one. Let's find some better stuff. Because there was always... There was always good trees. I remember at the end of every year, I'd tell you, there's nothing left. There's nothing left. By the end of the year, I mean June, the end of the easy digging season. And then by the next year, when you have that many trees, there'd be several hundred trees that had developed over the course of the year and changed. And of course, your eye develops, and you don't have the better trees from a year before to pick. But every year, there'd be new gems. That was one of the things that kept me passionate about the growing, because your new things just kept developing and appearing. And it was also a product of the pruning too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some of the, this would be me talking smack, some of the people that like to claim themselves as professionals and look for the spotlight are not very good at this, actually, with regard to picking raw stock.
Sure.
You see it in my what I call the can yard or the farm right now, where I've got a few hundred collected trees. Professionals come through and basically just lose their shit, right? Make poor choices, get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
I call it the crazy eye.
Mm-hmm.
and they just get overwhelmed. And I think that always makes me happy, because it just means I'm doing something right.
Yeah. It's interesting taking students through the can yard. And it was interesting walking with students through the field back in the day. And really, one of the things that is pretty cool to me is seeing students who evolve their eye and are able to find those trees that really are at the peak of sort of quality. But that is a learned skill set. And, you know, as you and I have worked together, and this comes back to what, when you stepped out the first time, we were talking about, just in terms of your eye that has evolved in the mountains, and Kendall, you know, talking about how do you maintain that sense of scale out there, and you talking about people that, you know, do go out and collect for themselves, and a lot of times what they bring back that does survive, they look at and say, why would I ever have collected that in the mountains? I mean, like, the culmination of knowledge and understanding of the future possibilities that you've really obtained, and seeing potential in trees that you didn't originally, and just that developing eye, and in the field, it's another skill set altogether, but ties into the same thing. I mean, bonsai as an art form, whether you're a collector, a grower, a ceramicist, a stand maker, or a professional who's styling trees and finishing trees, it's such a learned cumulative art form. You know, and coming back from Japan, what I was capable of doing in the first year coming back from Japan versus what I'm capable of now, or what I see, or the potential, or it's just not even the same thing. And everybody wants to try and cut that time frame down, which is, I think, where you see the sellability of conifers versus deciduous trees. But it's not, the final product is not something that you can obtain rapidly, because your skill set has to be there to obtain it, along with the tree has to be there and be ready for it, and all of the steps in between that finished product and what it starts out as is, I mean, that process is actually the value. It's actually what you pay, in my mind, what people pay for is actually the process. Not many people know that. Not many people will get to the end of that and say, wow, I just paid for that process. But that is what that growth with the tree, and that growth as an individual working with those trees, is what makes bonsai so valuable. You know, and that's an interesting thing to step back and see. For me, every time I wire and finish a tree, I'm in love with that tree because it's achieved this beautiful shape. But when I step back and I look at Mirai, or when I step back and I look at the can yard, you know, that your skills have created, or, you know, the field that you had created, the most satisfying thing was seeing that culmination of all of those years creating what is sitting in front of you, which is what causes people to lose their capacity to function in that situation. You know, and it's very easy to see the finished product and say, ah, I like that. But I think it's the people that create that finished product, that process, is what they're actually benefiting from, and where the impact of bonsai is the greatest, it seems to me. Mm-hmm.
Mic drop.
Mic drop. Yeah.
Well, you know,
gosh,
reminds
dang
me.
It. Just killing the conversation. I actually have to go. So if you guys want to wrap a little bit, that's great. Randy, I can't thank you enough, and I hope I didn't put you in a compromising position on the podcast.
No, not really at all.
Okay.
I just, I was more afraid of what I might say, because in the past, you and I've made some videos that, well, you know, we got feedback.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we've learned at Mariah that you're never going to make everybody happy. But I do truly appreciate you sitting down with us and sharing sort of you dumped 17 years of experience on us today. And anybody who's listening gets to experience the fruits of a really long, arduous journey that you've taken. So thank you very much.
Yeah,
you're welcome. I was just thinking, we barely scratched the surface.
Yeah.
And for all the aspiring collectors out there, I was on the phone with the shop. We were replacing the ball joints on my truck for the third time in the last 14 months. It's like 35,000 miles a year on the truck. And I really just collect. There's so much to know, so much to... It's really just a really big, long road. And, you know, we're never going to be at the end of it. And I mean, that's what I love.
You come back and talk to us again?
Yeah.
Cool. Cool. Thank you, guys. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you on the other side.
Yep. Please like, subscribe, and check us on iTunes. Bye-bye.